He says the fourth beast was completely and totally destroyed, and his body given to the burning flame, but the lion, the bear, and the leopard had their lives prolonged for a season and a time. A season, according to Brother Thomas, is a period of 280 years, being the number of years of the equivalent number of days for the period of gestation of a child, which is frequently styled in the scripture a season. So 280 days, the period of gestation of a child in years is 280 years, and a time, or two times, as Brother Thomas tells us it should be, is 360 years. So 360 plus 360 plus 280 makes exactly 1,000, and answers to the period of the millennium. So in the millennium, we are told that the lion, the bear, and the leopard will have their lives prolonged. Nationally, they will be caused to exist during the millennium, but not the fourth beast. Why should there be a difference made? Well, this was the point I was trying to make earlier. The lion, the bear, and the leopard represent national entities and geographical boundaries. Nations will still exist during the millennium. We're told that because in Zechariah chapter 14 we're told that if the family of Egypt doesn't come up, Egypt will still be known as Egypt. Countries will apparently still bear their names. There will still be the lion, the bear, and the leopard as far as national characteristics are concerned. But the fourth beast is not a national characteristic. The fourth beast is independent of all nationalities, is independent of all boundaries. It is a system. It is a system which cannot be tolerated and cannot be allowed to exist during the millennium. So whilst it is permissible for nations to continue on, represented by the lion, the bear, and the leopard, it of course is completely incomprehensible that God could allow to exist a system completely opposed to the truth. So this fourth beast has its body cast to the burning flame, whereas the other beasts will be allowed to exist on the basis, of course, of Ezekiel chapter 39, that they come along and they eat the blood, they eat the flesh, and they drink the blood of that national sacrifice which Yahweh is going to offer for them in the land of Israel. So that when Gog is destroyed, there is the doctrine of national atonement depicted. And those nations which are prepared to come along and acknowledge the righteousness of God in destroying Gog and saying that what was done to Gog could rightly have been done to us, the same principles of atonement as we apply in our personal lives now, they will have their lives prolonged for a season at a time. But the fourth beast, being a system, will be eradicated. So that is the difference. That's why Rome cannot exist, because Rome is not just geographical boundaries. The Roman beast is a dreadful and a terrible system, which later on in the chapter we are told spake great words against the Most High and wore out the saints of the Most High and thought to change times and laws. And this was the system then which had to be eradicated. So if we just come back then momentarily to our opening chart, you can see then what we're trying to say in this black section here in the division. What we're trying to say, of course, is that Catholic Rome was a geographically definable area. That Western Europe is a geographically definable area. But Christendom is a state of affairs that can exist anywhere. And whilst Western Europe will still exist in the kingdom, in the sense of a geographical entity, and Catholic Rome, which of course also spoke of Europe in another sense, will exist, not so Christendom. And so what we're looking at then at the moment is a system which is to be destroyed. So this beast then is going to present to us a symbolic representation of this system, which is the papal system. Well, that brings us now to the point where we can, one, I think, turn over our C90s. We've got any C90s there? We're about halfway. And get ready to go back to Revelation 13. Does anyone want to ask anything on that? Any quick questions at all before we... Go over to chapter 13. Well, hopefully what I've just said should really now make Revelation 13 become almost self-explanatory. That's the reason I did it. I didn't just sort of fill in half an hour by going back to Daniel chapter 7 for no reason at all. Hopefully now we should be able to look at this and say, I see what it's all about, with very little exposition on my part. So let's see how well we've done. Revelation chapter 13. I've got a comment first of all, which Brother Thomas doesn't pick up, but I think is nevertheless very relevant, and it's brought out by some of the more modern translations of the Bible. If you've read the notes, you'll see that I've commented on this here, and that is that Revelation chapter 13 verse 1 in the Authorized Version starts off with the statement, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns." Most modern translations translate that differently, and instead of the word "I stood," it's got "and he stood upon the sea." And that in fact, they make a full stop after the word "sea," and that whole phrase is tacked onto the end of chapter 12. So that if we go back to chapter 12, verse 17, it would go something like this: "And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God, and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, and he stood upon the sand of the sea." Full stop. And then the chapter starts off, "And I saw a beast rise up out of the sea." So it is just perhaps a technicality. As I said, Brother Thomas, surprisingly enough, hasn't picked it up in his translation. And so I've left his translation at the top of the page. You noticed how when we've made the notes up and we've put the actual verse at the beginning of each section, perhaps you've noticed this, have you, that I've always used Brother Thomas's translation? Well, I've continued to use his translation, even though the comment I've made suggests that there is a different translation of that verse. It doesn't really make any fundamental difference to the exposition. But I have noted that, and that is that the translators refer the preceding sentence, "He stood upon the sand of the sea," to the dragon of chapter 12, thus making that phrase the conclusion of chapter 12 rather than the beginning of chapter 13, bearing in mind that the chapter divisions were not put in by John or by Jesus, they were put in by later compilers. Well, the beast has seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. Well, we've come across this beast before. Where have we come across this beast before? Well, we came across this beast before 3 months ago, back in chapter 12. Seeing it's a long time, let's just have a look back at chapter 12 to see where we came across it before. Revelation chapter 12, verse 3. "And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns and seven crowns upon his heads." How good is our memory? What is the difference between the beast in chapter 12 and verse 3 as against the beast in chapter 13 and verse 1? What is the difference? They both got seven heads, ten horns. They both look much alike. What's the difference, though? No one game to attempt it? Sure, there's a lot of people know the answers. Yes, that's the answer to the next question, which I haven't yet asked. So we'll have to... Which was the What's the difference in the vision between the two of them? Right, yes. In chapter 12, the crowns are on the heads. In chapter 13, the crowns are on the horns. And then the next question was going to be, why? Well, now that's where Gary's answer comes in, so he wasn't really wrong, he just answered the extension of the question. It's because when the crowns were on the heads, that represented the period of Roman history when it was going through the various phases, the seven phases of the Roman government: the regal, the consular, the dictatorial, the decemviral, the tribunitial, the imperial, and the Gothic. But when finally that phase of Rome passed away, and the 10 various tribes out of the north came down, and they scattered the Romans back up into Europe, the crowns were no longer upon the imperial, or the dictatorial, or the consular heads back in Rome, but they were now worn by the 10 powers that had taken over Rome. In other words, the horns. Alright? So the seven heads were the seven forms of government, but the 10 horns were the tenfold divisions of the Roman Empire after it had fallen to the invading horns out of the north. So it's significant to note then that in chapter 12, the crowns indicating the power, the royalty, the ruling system, whilst it was on the heads in chapter 12, is now on the horns in chapter 13. So, remembering then that in chapter 12 we considered the period of Roman history down to the time of Constantine. That period when we had what was known as pagan Rome, which became Christian Rome by Constantine. We're now going to see a more detailed description of this Roman system at a time which is later, because the crowns are upon the horns. And upon his heads the name of blasphemy. This, of course, indicates that it's not just now a political power, but it's a religious power. It's a power which blasphemes. Reminds us of the quotation in Thessalonians, in the 2nd of Thessalonians chapter 2, and at verse 4, which speaks of this same system. The Apostle Paul looked forward to the time when this system would come. 2nd of Thessalonians chapter 2, and at verse 4, it speaks about this power who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, all that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And this is the sort of blasphemy that came forth from this beast. A beast which was to be the basis of the ultimate papal system. Alright, well, I think that's reasonably clear. We've seen this beast before. We now are introduced to a later stage of it. Verse 2. And here's where I hope Daniel 7 will answer all our problems for us. The beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were as the feet of a bear. His mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Why do you think the beast looked like a leopard and not like a bear or a lion? It looked like a leopard. Its feet were the feet of a bear, and its mouth was the mouth of a lion. You know, we could have easily said that it looked like a lion, and its mouth was the mouth of a bear, and its feet were the feet of a leopard. Oh no, it couldn't. But I say it could have. It could have been a, you know. Yes. That's half the answer. Yes, but there had been a later phase, because there had been also the dragon phase, in a sense. Look, that's half the answer. There's two parts to the answer. The leopard was certainly the last phase. You're saying the same as what Sister Hodges said, really. You know, nothing different. You're just sort of extending it in a few more words. I think there's a bit more to it than that. And I don't think Brother Thomas particularly brings it out in Eureka, but it's nevertheless relevant. The leopard represents Greece. The Roman Empire was divided up into two sections, Eastern and Western. What had happened to the Western section of the empire by this stage? Perhaps you don't know, because perhaps you don't know what stage we've reached, but, you know, we've passed the time of... well, I've finished that sentence, I've told you the answer. We've passed the time of Constantine anyway. Where's the Western Empire at this stage? Been eclipsed, yes. So what's left? Well, we're left with an empire which is now centred in Constantinople, and we're going to be looking at men like Justinian and Phocas. And these were men that ruled over in the other area, over in the area of the empire of the leopard. So you see, it's the territory of the leopard which becomes significant here. It's only a little detail, but it's an interesting little detail. We're going to find now that we're going to be looking at something which is taking place very largely in the eastern section of the empire, which is the ancient territory of the leopard. So whilst I say it's only a little point, but it shows to us just how accurate the scriptures are. So whilst it's essentially a Roman dragon, the beast looks like a leopard, because territorially we are now looking at that section which was the eastern section. For those who are not familiar with what we're talking about when we talk about Eastern and Western Rome, here's the period around about AD 450, which is getting up towards the time we're looking at. Justinian, you know, you've come across Justinian and Phocas before, because they were the start of two of the very important time periods, right? They're around about 500, 600. So this map's getting fairly close to it. But see what we've got here? We've got the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. If we go on with subsequent maps, and you have seen these maps before, and I don't know if I can certainly pick them out, but if we were to go on with subsequent maps, we would find that bit by bit, here's one, 626. This is now just after focus. We really want one between the two of them, but look what's happened there. Here's your Eastern Roman Empire. Then right across there, that's the Eastern Roman Empire. So what was originally a twofold empire, Western Rome and Eastern Rome, and you see Eastern Rome incorporates this territory of the leopard, it's now, as the Roman Empire has gone, Western Empire has gone, spread itself right across to here. So it's the emperors who are reigning here in Constantinople who become the power behind it, but it's the beast, it's the Roman system over here from Rome which gives it its power, which we're told here. The dragon gave him his power. So that's why I think it's very important that it had to be that the beast itself looked like a leopard, but its mouth was the mouth of a lion. And of course, what it was speaking was still Babylonian.
Yes,
I wasn't geographically defining the dragon. It was just the dragon of chapter 12 that we're talking about, which was essentially a Roman system. Because the dragon of Revelation chapter 12 was an earlier stage, which had started off as a Roman system moved over to Constantinople. Thanks anyway for the point. You're quite right. It could have come over wrongly there. Okay, so back to our point then about this. It looked like a leopard. That was the area. It spake as a lion. Let me ask you a question that I don't know that I've got the answer to. Why was its feet like a leopard, or like a bear? Well, perhaps you can think about that one. My suggestion would be that the bear, of course, which represented Medo-Persia, also represented a beast which is sort of heavy and ponderous, and sort of just, you know, it was like the Persian armies. When the Persians went to war, they took everything with them. You know, Herodotus talks about several million soldiers going with their wives, with their slaves, and with everything. They were never designed to sort of retreat. They just couldn't retreat. They just marched forward under sheer weight of numbers. And I feel that the bear is very representative of this sort of army. Whereas a leopard, representative of Alexander, was quick and fast. The bear was slow and ponderous. And of course the leopard was too quick for the bear eventually. But whilst the bear could trample down its enemies, so it was effective in its success. And so it was that this empire did eventually spread, as you saw on that last chart there. It spread right across, just slow and persistently, as a bear would do. It wasn't as though there was any great warfare taking place. It was a bit like the Persians. It just spread itself by its very power. That is my suggestion as to why it would be like the bear. In line with its type, namely the Persian Empire. Anyway, the whole overall picture we've got here is that here is a system now which has its roots back in the beast of Daniel chapter 7. The leopard, the bear, and the lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Made a comment in the notes that it was significant to note that the beast of the sea had the mouth of a lion. It's on top of page 139. Thus it promulgated a doctrine which emanated from Babylon, the Nimrudian capital of the kingdom of men. And just to reinforce the point that Michael picked me up on a moment ago, the dragon represented the civil power of Rome, now established in Constantinople, in case that message came across incorrectly before. Now here are the two kings that we're referring to, emperors rather. By the decree of Justinian in AD 535, and finally by the decree of Phocas in AD 607, the Bishop of Rome became universal pope with great authority. Justinian was probably the greatest. In fact, I think historians claim that he was the greatest of the emperors of the Eastern Roman Empire, that empire which eventually came to be known as the Byzantine Empire, the Empire of Byzantium. Justinian is best known for his famous law code. He codified the Roman laws. Up to this time it was very interesting. When anybody had a dispute, they took it to court. But this could drag on for ages and ages, because there were various law systems. One of them dated back to the time of the Republic. That's even before the time of the Empire, really. It went back to the time of the Republic. That was known as the leges, the laws. Then there was another system which came up in the time of the emperors, known as the Senatus Consultus, which had relationship to the laws of the Senate. And then following that, there was a whole series of laws which were made up by various lawyers who went back over previous cases and said, well, you know, back in AD 33, such and such a judge in such a place made this decision, and they would collect all of these laws, and so when you went to court, you had to hope that someone didn't come up with some other example which you hadn't heard of. And it became terribly complicated because it became a wrangle of who could cite the best examples of what you should do in a given case. So Justinian became famous for his codification of Roman law, and he established a law which essentially has come down to us today, Justinian's famous law code. And what he did was he set a whole lot of committees together, and they got all of these examples together, and they picked out what they thought were the best judgments so that they would have the closest thing to a foolproof system. So if, for example, you were to look up Justinian, say, in an encyclopedia, you would find that they would speak mostly about his law code. But the scripture isn't interested in that. And sometimes the things that the scripture notes a man for are things which history only vaguely comment on, because God is looking at it through his eyes. And if you do happen to, and I did check this out incidentally as an exercise in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and so it's got several pages on Justinian's law code, and it's got about a page and a half on his religious affiliations, and it hardly says anything about what he did in establishing the power of the Pope. Hardly comments on it. But in fact, that was one of the most important things, if not the most important thing, that he did. It was the most important thing. And the reason I'm commenting on this is that later on we're going to find a reference back to this period of 42 months, this 1260 years, which we've seen previously, was dated from the time of Justinian through to the French Revolution. So that Justinian gave a certain power to the papacy, which lasted for 1260 years. And it wasn't until the French Revolution came that finally that was done away. And so emperors like Justinian made famous decrees like this. You come to another fellow by the name of Phocas, and about all he's famous for is that there's a column, now called the Column of Phocas, still standing in the Forum Romanum in Rome. But, you know, they say that no baser wretch ever wore the papal crown, or the Roman crown. In fact, I think that's the comment we've got against a picture of it in the notes here, if I remember correctly. He only lasted for a couple of years. And again, if you look that up, I did look that one up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and they had about 2 inches on it. That's all they said about Phocas, as though he'd never existed. But this man gave further power to the papal beast. We've got a picture, I think, of that Column of Phocas somewhere in here. Well, I know we have, but it's just a matter of finding the page. Which page is it? 134. 119. No, it's not the one on 134. 119. That's right. I think this is the one that... Yes, the very last words. We take the last couple of sentences. The date of the pillar... let's read that whole note there. That will remind us of what we did earlier and consolidates our point. The principal bishop of the Catholic idolatry of Rome was developed into the god of all the earth by the legislative favour of the imperial power at Constantinople. This development was legislative and circumstantial and therefore progressive. Rome was pregnant with this blasphemous deity during a gestative period of 280 years, namely from 324 to 604. So from the time that Constantine first made Rome Christian to the time of the coming of Phocas was a gestative period of 280 years. There's that 280 again. The former being the date when Constantine became sole emperor and established Christianity as the state religion. He was quickened into political life by Justinian's code, that's that law code, and his decretal epistle in 533, which affirmed the Roman bishop's universal supremacy in spiritual affairs. 75 years after this, he was brought to the birth by the emperor Phocas, acknowledging the supremacy of his see, In grateful memory of this and other benefits, the Pope caused to be erected by the Exarch of Italy a Corinthian marble column standing on a pyramid of 11 steps and bearing a gilded statue of Phocas. The date of the pillar was AD 608, and it bore a Latin inscription to the following effect: for the innumerable benefits of his piety and for the quiet procure to Italy and the preservation of liberty. History, however, says perhaps a baser wretch than Phocas never wore the dragon crown, but not a more worthy in the estimation of the new god. So he was one of those terrible people that ever lived. Even the Encyclopedia Britannica calls him boorish and all sorts of names like this. But it was expedient for the Roman system to use him. So what have we got then? We've got a beast here now, which is made up of all of those beasts of Daniel chapter 7, the pagan dragon giving him power, but when he comes to power, he finds it expedient to give certain authority to the Roman system. I'm sorry, the papal system. The papal Roman system. So let's go back then to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 3. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, who is able to make war with him? Now, it's one of the heads that are wounded, not one of the horns. One of the heads. The head which was wounded was the sixth head. The sixth head was the imperial one. It was the sixth head which was mortally wounded. But his deadly wound was healed. So that this head was apparently wounded unto death, but it was later brought back to life in a new form. And as a result of the decree of Justinian, amongst other things, it paved the way for ultimately restoring an imperial power in the Roman Empire. But this is going to be the beast of the earth, which we're going to come to later on. And so when this wound is healed, it would eventually bring about the restoration of the imperial power of Rome. Now, I think it would be expedient if I stopped at this stage. We're starting to get into another section of it, and I think it would be better if we leave people's minds reasonably clear without now trying to get into this later stage. So let me just take about 2 minutes to try and summarise the salient features that we've got this evening, which becomes the basis then of looking at the rest of this chapter. We've got a vision in Daniel chapter 7 which presents to us an overall picture of the kingdom of men set out historically. The lion, the bear, the leopard, and the dreadful and terrible unnamed fourth beast. When we come to Revelation chapters 12 and 13, we have a more detailed description of this fourth beast. But it is interesting to note that this fourth beast still incorporates the features of some of the previous three. Because after all, the kingdom of men never changes in principle. It only changes in the extent of its empire, the constitution of the empire, or where the throne may be placed from one empire to the next. So when we come to Revelation chapter 13, we're looking now at a papal system. We're not looking so much at a kingdom, we're looking at a system. The system is going to be founded principally in the territory of the leopard, that is in the ancient Grecian Empire. It's going to have the doctrine, though, which comes from Babylon. And as a result of this, one of the things it's going to do is it's going to attempt to re-establish imperial Rome. That is, the Rome of the empire, of the emperors. And that it is going to do as a result of making a coalition with the papacy. And of course, having said that, it immediately sparks off in our mind, well, that's what's going to happen again. Because Russia's going to come down and you're going to take Constantinople. Having taken Constantinople, it will also make a coalition with the papacy. And what are we going to have? We're going to have the latter-day Assyro-Babylonian Empire again. It's going to be there in the territory of the leopard, I'm not saying that this is to be the fulfillment of these verses here. All I'm saying is that it's remarkable that these things come right down in parallel form. And we're going to see once again the Constantinople and Roman Confederacy setting itself up, which will cause Nebuchadnezzar's image to stand erect, preparatory to being overthrown. Well, we've been looking mainly at history tonight, and as you know, over the months I've said that we want to keep history to a minimum. This is, of course, a section where we can't dodge the history. But I think there is still an obvious exhortation to us, a simple one, but a very profound one. When we go out of here tonight, don't forget that whatever we see about us is part of this system. It's just as much Babylonian as it ever was. And if we find ourselves starting to like something in this world which is not directly of the truth, then we've got to look very, very carefully at ourselves. We can explain it away. We can start to find that some occupation may be enjoyable to us, some pastime, some pleasure, something like that. But brethren and sisters, we've got to be very, very careful. This is the mouth of Babylon. It doesn't just come over in words, it comes over in a system of indoctrination where the mass media and all of the influences of this life tell us that we've got to seek for some sort of satisfaction in our daily occupation. The only satisfaction we get in our daily occupation is serving our master as unto Christ. If we start to be looking for great things in our daily occupation, if we start to be looking for advancement to the end that we might receive positions of prominence and honour, there's something wrong. The mouth of Babylon has started to affect us. The only satisfaction that we look for in life is a satisfaction that we are serving our earthly master faithfully and well, as unto the Lord. And if we do progress along in life, it is something which God has given to us for a purpose which he sees fit. It may be a blessing, it may of course be a testing. If we find ourselves having a need to accumulate certain things which are going to give us recreation, as we say, that we might give us relaxation, and if you think I'm talking about television sets and that, you're quite correct. If we think that we need those things, we've been influenced by Babylon. There's nothing in the Bible that tells us we need these things. There is need, of course, brethren and sisters, to realise that the Bible talks to us straight. It's trying to show to us in studying the book of Revelation that that system out there is just as much this dreadful and terrible unnamed beast as it ever was. And it speaks to us, of course, in different forms today. If we want our minds to be influenced by the things of Babylon, then we can only blame ourselves for the rejection which may come to us when the Lord says, you've preferred to serve mammon rather than me. And so may we suggest, brethren and sisters, that we've got to be very critical of ourselves. I'm not talking about being critical of others. I'm talking about being critical of ourselves. This is what the book of Revelation presents to us, that here is the mind of God. This is the way he sees the world. If the book of Revelation means anything to us, then that's the way we should see the world, and we should reject it, because we recognise it is a system only fit for destruction. And the sooner it is destroyed, the sooner God's glory can be revealed in the earth, and might it be that in his mercy we will be amongst those who will be chosen to help reflect that glory in the age to come.
Brethren and sisters, we look for the time when that system of iniquity which was revealed to us in the 13th chapter of the Apocalypse will be destroyed, when God's judgment will be revealed in the earth. Let us therefore bring our meeting to a close by singing together hymn number 198. Lord, thy judgments now are waiting. Hymn number 198.